What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal points and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in a legal face-off on WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagle, Rich Lenkoff, is here, and joining us today, Kathleen Murphy, who's the Director of Communication at the Illinois Opportunity Project. Welcome to the Batcave. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I've heard you get at least a year on the tryout. You get at least one full
awesome.
Year before we do anything else.
Yeah.
So you should be comfortable.
Sitting in the Jason Whiteside chair. And Sam's back after a week off. Where are you covering on the road for UIC?
In Mississippi, in Hattiesburg.
Who are not following the day-to-day baseball news for UIC, how'd they do?
They lost 8-7 and 5-4.
Oh.
So they were both crushing.
Three-game playoff?
Double a limb.
Wow.
Lost 8-7, lost 5-4.
In Hattiesburg?
In Mississippi.
How's the
sweet tea was great. The barbecue was
good.
Yeah, I was going
to say, where do you go to drown your sorrows in Mississippi?
Yeah. Well, it was fun. It's great to be back. We've got plenty to talk about today. We've got some jury duty scuffles. We've got Fox News making more news. And then the LSAT issues with that, the grab bag as well. But let's start.
Cosby, by the way. Lots of Cosby news, obviously.
Yeah, certainly. Jean Christensen is a partner at Wigdor LLP, and she's very, very in tune with what's going on with Fox News. She joins us now here in Chicago. Hello, Jean. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Gene, you were one of the lead attorneys suing Fox News for various forms of discrimination. Bring us up to speed as to what is going on with your lawsuit on behalf of your clients.
Sure. Well, presently we have one action that was filed in Supreme Court Bronx County that was originally filed on behalf of two plaintiffs. We added a third plaintiff, and as of today we now have 13 former and current employees in that particular case. And then we have also filed two separate actions in federal court for three different people. We're in the process of drafting another complaint for racial harassment. And then we have two pending separate cases for gender discrimination and retaliation that we just filed.
So Bill O'Reilly left. We all know that. Roger Ailes, who founded Fox News, left, was fired, depending on how you interpret that. He subsequently died recently. There's other leaders at Fox News who have left, who you're suing. Detail for us a little bit what you're alleging against these individuals and against the corporation.
Sure. In the primary case that I mentioned in the Bronx County, that is a case that's filed against Fox, the corporate entity, and Fox News Network, and it also names individually Diane Brandy, who is the longtime general counsel at Fox, and a woman named Judith Slater, who was the former controller of Fox. And that case is based on pervasive racial discrimination at the corporate offices.
So, Jean, in cases like this, what does a plaintiff need to prove? What evidence do you have to bring forward?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is that it depends on exactly what causes of action you're alleging for the discrimination. Mm-hmm. Here, we are alleging that Slater engaged in blatant racial discrimination on a continuous and long-term basis, mm-hmm. such that other executives at the company were aware of what she was doing, including Diane Brandy, the general counsel, and we also name other senior executives. And what the plaintiffs need to show is that Fox was on notice of this discrimination and that it failed to take any action. And so, that's what we will be able to prove.
And one of the allegations specifically against Judith Slater, who you mentioned, was Fox News' former comptroller, who was fired in March, let go, however you want to describe it. One of the allegations is that your client, who worked for Slater, claims that she was refused to Slater refused to make her a permanent employee with benefits, yet the allegation goes she hired white people to do the same job with benefits, and that Fox fired your client after she gave birth to her child.
Right. That is in the case that you mentioned is one of the singular cases that we filed separately in federal court. And I won't bore you with the reasons that they're procedural and have to do with statute of limitations. But that is exactly what we alleged in that case. And there are similar allegations in the larger Bronx County case for some of those individuals as well. We alleged that Slater repeatedly kept persons of color on as temporary employees, but then when it came time to actually make somebody a permanent employee, she selected white employees.
Jean, it seems to me as I've been reading about these cases and just listening to you that Fox really does have a cultural problem within their corporation. So as an attorney, when you are reaching settlements, is there anything that you can do to influence a change in that culture?
We're trying very hard. It's a great question. The answer is it depends. In specific cases, it depends on who the employer is. Sometimes employers are more willing to look at that in the settlement negotiations. Others don't want to discuss that. Here, we're trying very hard to make that part of negotiations that we want to see, the clients want to see, changes, systemic changes in the corporate culture at Fox.
Are you also representing the individual who, Bob Beckel, who has now been fired from The Five, who he allegedly made a racist remark to? Is that also one of your clients?
It is, and we have not filed anything in connection with that particular case yet, but we will be doing that shortly.
So the allegations are not just for sexual discrimination, because the great majority of the accusers are female, but also in this case as an example, and in the case of the other client of yours that we just mentioned, that there's also racial discrimination going on at Fox News, correct?
Correct. I mean, we also have one particular client whose claims, for example, are only in the EEOC, again, for procedural reasons. But he was a longtime manager in Fox in the accounts receivable department and a person of color and somebody who we allege Judith Slater singled out based on his skin color for, you know, not giving him raises, not promoting him and subjecting him to discrimination.
So what do you make, because I work in politics, what do you make of people's arguments that this is somehow politically motivated because Fox has a center-right perspective? Do you have any, you know, does that impact what you're doing at all?
And also the fact that Trump has come out and supported
Roger Ailes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's come out and said that, you know, in essence, Bill O'Reilly did nothing wrong before these allegations came out, which, you know, in my opinion is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, regardless of how you feel about Trump, I mean, for him to support, you know, someone who's been accused of these crimes and who subsequently resigned as a result of them, mm-hmm. I think is, you know, Trumpian, no doubt, but completely wrong.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to discrimination, especially the severity that's alleged in these particular cases, both against O'Reilly and Ailes and the cases that we're involved in, I mean, there's no space for political parties. I mean, it's beyond that. This is individuals engaging and targeting in people of protected classes, their gender, their skin color, that simply doesn't belong in corporate culture in 2017. And employees speaking out now is basically, you know, there's always a tipping point. And for somebody to come forward in cases like this, it's never easy. Mm-hmm. I think that's a common misconception. Plenty of times we have clients tell us that they call the office and hang up as soon as somebody answers because they're too afraid to actually make the call. And that, in fact, happened with one of the plaintiffs in this case. So I don't think that the timing is particularly relevant as far as the political connection. I just think that people are no longer willing to tolerate this on a day-to-day basis.
last question, Gene. There's a lot of power in television. We know that, especially with the big networks like Fox. How many obstacles have you had to deal with? How much red tape is there when you try and get close to what's really going on?
For us right now, since we're in the initial stages of litigation, that isn't something that we've come up against because, you know, we're actually trying to make progress. And in that regard, we've been dealing with Ofcom and speaking to them as far as the 20th Century Fox's attempt to take over Sky. So I think that for now, it's not something that is going to curtail us moving forward or us potentially resolving this matter.
If you need co-counsel for the Bill O'Reilly deposition, I'm just throwing it out there that I'm available.
And get ready. There will be red tape, I promise.
That will be a good one.
Yes.
Gene Christensen is a partner at Wigdor LLP, the website wigdorlaw.com, WIGDORlaw.com. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, WGNradio.com. Joining us now on the phone, he's a professor at the University of the District of Columbia, the David A. Clark School of Law, Professor Andrew Ferguson. Hello, how are you?
Doing well, thanks very much.
Professor, you wrote a book entitled Why Jury Duty Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Constitutional Action. Tell us why jury duty scofflawing, if that's a verb, is a problem.
We have a growing crisis of people not showing up for jury duty in America. In recent years, one-third of citizens in California counties like Los Angeles and San Diego failed to show up. In Texas, outside of Houston and Harris, Montgomery County, we had no-show rates of up to 75% to 86%. In Philadelphia, I think in 2016, only 14% of people summoned for jury duty showed up. These are difficult crisis numbers in some places, and they have real-world consequences. In Youngstown, Ohio, and Natchez, Mississippi, there were not enough jurors for a murder trial. So imagine being the victim's family showing up to see justice done, and not enough citizens showed up to make the court go forward. Or imagine being that defendant and recognizing that your day in court can't go forward because not enough citizens showed up to do their duty.
So what are the costs that are incurred when you have to delay a trial? Because I imagine that's passed on to taxpayers who are, you know, families and businesses who are already trying to make ends meet. So when trials are delayed like that, what does that cost?
Well, there's obviously an economic cost and an efficiency cost for having to sort of reconvene court. But these are cases, like if you try a murder trial, there's a lot of work that goes on before that trial is to go on. Even in civil cases, there's a lot of work that happens before that moment of the jury. And the idea that all of those coordinated schedules, coordinated witnesses, all of that work is put to nothing at the moment because not enough citizens showed up on their appointed day is really, financially, economically, a negative. But it's more about the people. I just can't imagine what it's like to be that victim's family and sitting in that room and being told, actually, we can't go forward today because not enough citizens showed up for jury service. It's just outrageous.
Professor, I try a lot of jury trials. My last trial was a couple of months ago. And I would love to serve on a jury. Like being a trial lawyer, I would just love to be in that room and find out, you know, whether all my preconceived notions of what really goes on happens. So I'm always looking, you know, to sit on a jury. But, you know, when I'm doing voir dire, I've seen some amazing things that you're probably familiar with, having, you know, studied jurors for your book. But my last one, I had a guy show up. And he, you know, said, "Oh, I don't believe in the government. I believe in anarchy, and as such, I can't serve on this jury." And you know, this guy was clearly putting on a show and just trying to get out of jury duty. And to his credit, our judge didn't let him off the hook. He asked him a couple of questions, and the judge said, "You know, even though you might not believe in the government, guess what? You're living in this country. You have to serve your duty." And the judge would not let him off for that case. Now, he was off for another reason, which I think was a good thing, because he was kind of, you know, a whack job, to use a very technical legal term. But yeah. I'm sure you've seen your share of colorful attempts to get off juries.
I have. And so before being a law professor, I was a trial lawyer. I tried cases in front of juries. And the reason I wrote this book is because I actually saw, you know, that same attempt over and over again. I walked past the jury room every time I went into court, and I saw those grumpy faces. I saw those people who looked like they wanted to be anywhere else in the world. But then once they served, I'm sure you've had this experience too, once they've served and sat in that process and done what they didn't think they could do and come to a decision with strangers who they otherwise would not know and did it well, usually, they're really proud. And I realize that there are all these stories that were not told about people who had positive experiences in jury service, and to recognize that this was a positive moment of our civic lives. And this was a positive moment for our court system, and that we should tell that positive story.
Well, Kathleen, Sam, have you guys ever served on juries? I know, Kathleen, you said you did when earlier. Sam?
I've dodged the bullet every time.
Sam is one of our
scofflaws.
Sam
is one of our scofflaws. But one of the issues, obviously, is one of the issues is the compensation. Here in Illinois, where I practice, jurors get $25 a day for the first day, and then $50 for every day afterwards. You know, which for some people is okay. For a lot of people, though, that's not, you know, nearly enough compensation. How big a factor is remuneration in people's desire to get off juries?
I think it's a big factor. I think it's a real factor. I don't think you can minimize the fact that we do not compensate people enough for doing their civic duty. Chicago and Illinois in general has changed the rules. Like that monetary fee is more than it had been. It's more than it is in many places across the country.
Yeah, it was $17 in Cook County, and the statewide law made it up, raised it to $25, which is still, you know, not a lot of money, obviously.
But the state doesn't have a lot of money.
Right, exactly. Lucky to even get that.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a function of where we put our priorities. I think that as a society, we shouldn't be terribly surprised that people are shirking jury duty, in part because we don't compensate them financially, but in another part, we don't educate them. I mean, one of the reasons why people feel that they don't want to do it or they don't know if they can do it is we do very little to educate jurors before they show up for jury service to give them confidence that they can do this. I mean, it's pretty surprising if you think about it. Today, you're sitting at home, you get a letter in the mail, and somebody says, you're going to go judge other people, and you say to yourself, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge, I've never been trained. How am I going to do this? And that doubt is real because we haven't done enough as a society to say that people, ordinary people, can do this and they can do it well. And in fact, the whole reason we have a jury system is so that ordinary people can do it well. And we should invest more, both financially in terms of how we pay them, but also how we educate our fellow citizens about why this is an important duty. It's a constitutional duty. I like going around and saying that, you know, jury duty is constitution duty. You think you get summoned because the court sent you something. Actually, it's a constitution sending you something. This is your obligation, your duty, your responsibility as part of being an American citizen.
I think that's a really good point, because when you look at other, you know, your other civic duties, voter turnout has decreased year after year after year. Is it consistent with, you know, how we're educating people about what their responsibilities to their community is?
And it's a function of, if you think about being a voter, is not merely like showing up and just like pulling the lever or picking the person, right? It's about
Absolutely.
All the information that goes before that.
Understanding, yep, what you're supporting. Absolutely.
And we don't do that for juries, right? I mean, to me, it almost borders on irresponsible. that you would go to the jury duty, and the first time you'd ever think about the concept of negligence or beyond a reasonable doubt is in that jury room, right? Mm-hmm. Why not? There's nothing. Right now, you, me, every single American citizen is a potential juror. Mm-hmm. And yet, what are we doing to prepare for that moment? Nothing, right? We won't even do it even when we get the summons, right? Mm-hmm. And that is our failure to recognize that this is something that we should care about, that we should, it brings, you know, strangers together to do hard work. It's a little microcosm of democracy. And as you know from trying cases, it works. It works every single day that this system works. And it's sort of a way, you know, it's a symbol to show that, you know, small d democracy can still work in America.
Well, so does it work? We'll let you out of here with that question, Professor, because, you know, I think that raises a really interesting point about the jury system. You know, is it really the best system to entrust to 12 strangers who generally have not had a lot of education about legal matters, who, as you said, are walking into a complex medical malpractice case, not knowing the basics of negligence, for example? Is it the best system to treat, to leave these complex issues and decisions involving, you know, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to 12 people that in some ways couldn't get out of jury duty? Mm-hmm. Is that the best system, and are there ways to fix that?
Well, the short answer to that is all you have to do is ask judges, who will say that juries do a very good job of deciding cases, even hard cases. But that argument could also apply to democracy itself. Why would we trust, like, people who didn't really pay attention to anything to vote? But we do, because that's our system. And the founders created a system where the power resides in that whole we the people, which is part of showing up to be a judge of your community on jury duty. And that is, you know, we could have a election based on the experts who really understand all of these things. But we choose to let ordinary citizens educate themselves, be engaged, be involved, and that's what we think of as our democratic republic. Mm-hmm. Jury service is just a manifestation of it, and it's an everyday manifestation where you get to sort of practice the skills of democracy and learn that this is what it means to be a constitutional actor.
He's Andrew Ferguson, professor of law, University of the District of Columbia, the David A. Clark School of Law. Thank you for your time here on WGN.
Thank you.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us on iTunes as well. Legal Face Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Rich Lenkoff and Kathleen Murphy. And joining us now on the phone, we didn't have to go far. He's in Chicago. He's at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, Dean Daniel B. Rodriguez. And he joins us now on WGN. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dean, so early last year, the University of Arizona College of Law started what seems to be a growing trend by accepting either the GRE, Graduate School Entry Exam, or the more traditional LSAT, Law School Aptitude Test, from applicants. Is this a trend that you see growing around the country, and in particular at your law school, Northwestern?
Yes, but. Yes, I think it is a trend. As you know, not long after Arizona announced they were going to do this, Harvard Law School, my alma mater, announced that it was going to start considering the GRE as an alternative to the LSAT. A number of law schools, including mine, are hard at work studying and evaluating the efficacy of the GRE as an admissions test. And depending on what we find, we may well decide to go in that direction. And I suspect a number of other schools are doing so as well. The reason I add the but is because as I'm sure you know, the ABA accreditation standards look askance, I think would be fair to say, on the use of a test alternative to the LSAT. They can speak for themselves, but what they have said publicly is that they are not committed at this point to permitting an alternative test. They're going through a careful process now evaluating this. And, of course, our ability as a law school, an accredited law school, to take the GRE as an alternative depends fundamentally on what the ABA requires or doesn't require by way of standards.
Daniel, aside from increasing enrollment, which seems to be the goal, what are the other goals? Because it's strange to me that you'd move from the LSATs, which is specifically designed to assess preparedness for the rigors of law school, to the GRE, which is a more general test that assesses preparedness for graduate school in a range of degrees. And are you at all concerned that this is going to reduce the standard or the quality of the education students get in law school?
Well, that's, as we say in the law business, a leading question.
and a compound.
Let me just quickly say the premise of your question. Our desire is not to increase the enrollment of the student body. We have the good fortune of having this is an infomercial for Northwestern. We have the great good fortune to have thousands and thousands of applicants, all of whom have taken the LSAT. We're really looking to diversify the student base. And what the GRE provides, as you correctly point out, because it's a more test more generally suited to graduate school, of which law school is a part, is it looks to test a variety of skills, and thus the applicant pool might be folks who have thought about business school, which have been taking the GREs now for a number of years, most business schools, other forms of graduate school. So it really diversifies the applicant pool. But absolutely we're concerned to make sure that any admission test is well suited to, as you put it, the rigors of legal education. That's part of why we and Harvard and Arizona and other schools are studying this issue very carefully to make sure that we're not shooting ourselves in the foot.
So, you know, Northwestern, as you mentioned, is doing great, one of the best law schools in the country. You're a Harvard alum, obviously, you know, right up there. But some other schools around the country are not doing as well. There are many schools that have closed recently. Lots of schools are looking for applicants. In 2015, the most recent stats that we have, there was 54,000 people who applied to law school. That was a 38% decrease from 5 years earlier. So certainly some schools, I think, are looking at this as a way to increase enrollment. Do you think that GRE being physically more accessible, in other words, you can use it on, you could do it on the computer versus the LSAT, which is only four times a year at designated testing centers. Do you think all of that are reasons why schools are also considering it?
Well, obviously, each school should speak for themselves. With that caveat, I think you're onto something important, which is a very large number of schools are looking for various ways of increasing their applicant pool, given the downturn, and certainly making giving the opportunity for students to take a more accessible test in the way that the GRE is one possibility. I should also mention that one of the outcomes of the consideration of the taking of the GRE will be, quite frankly, to push the Law School Admission Council, which implements the LSAT, to be more flexible about its own testing. It's not so much redoing the entire test, but providing a much more modern way of being able to take the LSAT, because the whole issue is access, to create reduction of barriers to entry, so all individuals who might be interested in law school will have an adequate opportunity to take a suitable test.
Are there any other fields of study, such as medicine, that are changing their admission standards to provide access?
You know, I don't know about medicine, but I mentioned in passing business schools, and one of the interesting developments over the course of the last decade or so has been the gradual or not so gradual expansion of opportunity in business schools, which have long relied on the GMAT, the graduate management test. But in recent years, most of the nation's business schools, and certainly the vast majority of the nation's top business schools, will consider the GRE as an alternative to the GMAT. So in many respects, the law schools have just been following along that trend. I don't know about other professional schools like medicine.
Dean, with the 2 minutes or so we've got left, we'd like to take advantage of the fact that we'd love to have local and national law school deans in. We recently had one of your colleagues, Dean Rosetta Pareo from DePaul law schools who I know very well. What is the current state of law school graduates as you see it? You know, obviously there's lots of issues that we're dealing with. We mentioned the overall decline in enrollment. Obviously, leaving law school with a large debt is something that you and your folks and your students deal with. There are something like 500,000 lawyers in the country right now. We're adding, you know, about 40,000 each year. Those are some of the issues that we commonly see. But if you had to, you know, peg one of those or others as the issue that is, you know, biggest among you and your colleagues, what would that be?
I'll mention one, and to me, it's the most exciting, truly exciting development in, as you know, with hard facts, a difficult world, and that is the broadening sense that legal education and a JD degree equips graduates to do a variety of very interesting jobs, particularly new jobs at the intersection of the law, business, and technology. So I think the takeaway from what a number of law schools, including law schools in the Chicagoland area, are doing is adapting our curriculum and developing new modalities of education to equip our students not only to hang out a shingle or to join a mega law firm, but to actually take advantage of the great, difficult, complex positions that that legal education, increasingly interdisciplinary legal education, equips our graduates to perform.
That's Dean Daniel Rodriguez from Northwestern University, the Pritzker School of Law. You've been following the basketball program too. Did you go down and see that win over Vanderbilt?
I sure did. We were in Salt Lake City.
I bet you went, didn't you?
First time to the tournament. It was great. If it wasn't for a bad call, we might have passed Gonzaga. But that's water under the bridge, as they say.
It's one of the great plays that I've ever seen in my career following sports. I mean, just an unbelievable play.
Yeah, we're looking forward to a great future in hoops and also in football.
That can hurt. That can hurt. You know, the law school. I'm sure it's brought a lot of attention. I mean, not that Northwestern needs law school needs, you know, more, but I'm sure athletics has helped your job in various forms.
You bet. We like to see a lot of purple on television and in the sports facilities.
Just no more crying kids.
No more crying kids. Crying of happiness.
Yes, yes. Take care, Dean. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, thanks a lot.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Favorite part of the show, Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face-Off on WGN with Rich, Kathleen, and Sam. And our first topic, look who's back in the news, Bill Cosby.
The greatest gift to Legal Face-Off. This is day five of his criminal trial. Today, it's expected that the prosecution will continue. The prosecution has so far called the accuser, Andrea Constand, to the stand. She gave pretty vivid testimony over the last couple of days about the allegation against Bill Cosby, primarily that he gave her these drugs, and she testified that she felt like she was frozen. Today, it's expected that an expert will testify for the prosecution that the feeling of being frozen in the manner she testified is consistent with the drugs that she's alleged he gave her.
Yes. I cannot help but feel for this girl. She was on the stand for 5 hours, recalling one of the most traumatic things that has ever happened to her. And you're a legal expert. How important is the witness's testimony in these cases? Because sexual assault is very hard to prove. It's you know, happens in private circumstances. How much is a jury looking at this?
Yeah, great questions. I mean, that's the key to the whole case, right? The credibility of the witnesses, mm-hmm. the credibility of the accuser versus the defendant. In this case, Bill Cosby has said he won't testify. Yeah. So, you know, it's not really a he said, she said as much as really judging the testimony of the accuser.
Right.
Unfortunately, in these kind of cases, prosecution does go after the accuser, you know, very strongly, and they go after her with everything.
Right.
That is why most accusers are reluctant to come forward in these kind of cases, because you're going to have your whole life turned, you know, turned upside
Absolutely.
Down.
And you know, have a room full of people judging you to try and see if you're lying or not.
I mean,
it's just, I can't imagine a worse, you know, thing to have to go through after something like
Absolutely.
That.
Very, very difficult, very embarrassing. But, you know, to her credit, I think she's come forward. By all accounts, she testified very confidently. She came across as very credible. Now, the defense did attack her on a couple of issues. They talked about the fact that she called Bill Cosby 50 times or so after this alleged incident.
Mm-hmm.
They extensively went through the phone records to show that.
Mm-hmm.
Her response was that, yes, I was confused. Mm-hmm. I was still talking to him. He was a position of authority. He was the most famous alum of Temple University, where I was, you know, going.
Mm-hmm.
They also talked about the fact that she called other lawyers trying to show that she's in this for the money. I'm not at trial, obviously, but by all accounts, she did very well in response to those questions.
Right. Well, and I'm not a psychologist, but I don't think that that's uncommon behavior for someone who's been abused or assaulted, is to identify with her,
right,
with the abuser.
Absolutely. You know, I was on the Bill and Wendy show here on WGN mm-hmm. yesterday, and we were talking about, you know, the fact that Bill Cosby is appearing very nonchalant about this.
Yeah.
You know, he's leaving court saying, hey, 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 his Fat Albert, you know, saying. And, you know, I think there is some merit to the idea that because he's a celebrity, a lot of jurors are going to give him a break, unfortunately. I mean,
sure.
He's, aside from O.J. Simpson, probably the most famous criminal defendant in history when you think about
mm-hmm.
it. So I think, unfortunately, jurors will latch on to celebrity, his celebrity status. And then the other question is, how much influence will the other accusers have on the jury in this case?
Right. You know what I think is interesting about that, just is his celebrity status, is that, you know, this is obviously playing out in the court of public opinion with the 40 other accusers. This is just the only one testifying. Is that none of his co-stars from The Cosby Show, no one that he worked with on that, has come forward. You know, even Dennis Hastert, when he was accused of pedophilia, he had a list of people who came forward, including Tom DeLay. I mean, very high-profile people came forward in his defense and
right.
spoke up for him. No one has done that in this case, which I think is an interesting, you know, sort of telling piece
sure.
of piece of evidence playing out in the public
yeah
opinion.
And his wife or his four daughters have mm-hmm. not appeared in court this
right.
week at all, which I think is pretty telling. You know, he did trot out a couple of actresses, including one of them who was on the show, but yeah
mm-hmm.
for the most part I think, you know, they've all been silent, which I think is pretty telling. I mean, you know, have you ever served on a jury?
I have. I was in college. I served on, it was an assault case.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, you actually did your civic duty, unlike our previous topic discussed. But would you allow, I mean, obviously most people say no, but
mm-hmm.
if you were sitting on this jury,
mm-hmm.
you would know about the 40 other accusers.
Right.
The question would be, would you be able to put aside any preconceived notions about guilt or innocence,
right.
knowing that these accusers are out there, even though you were told, you would have been told by the judge in this case to not let that influence your decision? How would you approach that?
I think that's a really tricky thing. I mean, obviously impartiality is the goal, but how do you completely negate all your personal experiences? And I mean, even when to look at somebody who's testifying in any case, you have your idea of what somebody does when they're being honest, what, you know, characteristics they display, and that's almost subconscious. So I think that is, you know, that's part of being on a jury, and it's not an easy thing to filter out.
Yeah, and in fact, in this case, the prosecution, you know, said to the jury in opening statements that this is 2017. It's not 1970. The
right.
days of sequestering juries are over. The days of finding jurors who have not heard about a case are over. Mm-hmm. So obviously the people on this jury know about the accusations. And I think you're right. I think the reality is most people would say, yes, I'm not going to let that influence my decision. The reality is it will. It's impossible. You know, those 40 women or so will be in that trial regardless of whether they're physically there.
Well, this, and as a lawyer, do you think that this changes the legal profession? I mean, now you do have to get your side of the story. You do have to be, you know, in the press and in the media with your side of the story on these cases.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, the fact that Bill Cosby has not come out as vocally as the accusers, I think hurts him. I think, to your point, yes, because a lot of this is played out in the media and everyone's heard about it, if you're accused of these crimes, you almost have to make the case in the court of public opinion on media. Cosby's been pretty silent. You know, he has given deposition testimony that
which
hurts
was
him.
Not good. Yeah.
Yeah, it hurts him. I mean, he admitted in the civil case involving Andrea Constan that he drugged her. That's going
to
come
and
out.
And that he did that
right.
in order to have sex with women. And
right. So
lawyers say it wasn't to, you know, it was not to take advantage of him. Well, then what was it for?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's clear that he's guilty. But I think there's a pretty good chance that he's not convicted because of all these other things that are being brought up.
Update from Springfield. I don't know if it's much of an update. Again, no budget. What's the latest with Springfield?
Well, so it's actually some legal news. A federal judge on Wednesday ordered Comptroller Susana Mendoza to make a substantial dent in the $2 billion backlog of bills owed to Medicaid. What's interesting to note is that despite the budget impasse, the state has been able to pay all of its, you know, to make its pension payments on time.
Where's that money coming from?
Well, the state has a lot of money. Yeah. And actually, this year, the state spent more money than it has in years that we've had a fully funded budget and one-party rule. So it's a series of court orders, kind of appropriated spending, and then autopilot programs that they fund. So what your listeners might be interested in knowing actually on that topic is that the state has, from 2000 to 2015, the state's revenue increased by 57%. At the same time, it's the way we spend the money. We have a lot of money. It's if you look at what they spent the money on, spending on higher education went up about 8%. Spending on social services went down about 10%. Spending on public sector pensions and benefits increased over 500%.
Yeah, I mean, the pension situation is what's causing, you know, this issue, I think. We have covered workers' comp reform extensively on our show. I do workers' comp myself, and that seems to be dead. I mean, there's two bills that passed both houses that are in front of Rauner, but they're Democrat proposals.
Absolutely.
I think Rauner is not going to come close to signing them. The question is, do the Democrats have enough to overcome his veto? I don't think they have quite enough of those numbers, but
they lost their veto-proof majority in the House.
Right.
So it would be tremendously difficult. I don't think they can. But this is all a game. The things that get passed, it's all a game. We could have had a budget for the past 2 years. They had veto-proof majorities in the House and the Senate. They didn't want it. They wanted the gridlock. They want this to be on the governor. They want him to be the one who has to pass the tax increase. And the budget that they did push through a budget in Springfield last days of session, and it was Senate Democrats pushed it through. They abandoned all negotiations, right? Any talk of spending cuts and budget and revenue increases, abandoned that, pushed through a 32% income tax hike on families. So this would have, they rosiest estimations, $500 billion this would bring into the state. Well, the problem with that is we are projected to have a $14 billion backlog of bills. So not only should spending cuts and reforms be a part of the conversation, it should be the only conversation we cannot tax our way out of this. We cannot borrow our way out of this. We have to reform the way we fund government.
It's a lot of math, and I get confused. I just get confused.
Sam's ears are smoking over there.
I know, so Rich. I know
five
you're.
$5 billion is less than 14.
I know you're a big fan of 19 Kids and Counting.
Love any show. Love any show that is based on the lack of birth control, basically.
So Josh Duggar, one of the Duggars on that show, claims that media reports about him molesting his sisters caused him severe emotional distress.
Yeah, you know, you every time we're on the show, we get one of these head-shaking stories when you just, like, can't believe this is actually happening, and probably the reason why people hate lawyers.
I don't really feel for the guy. I mean,
the guy's, I mean, this guy molested four sisters, one as young as five at the time.
He also has an Ashley Madison account.
Yeah, he's like,
he's
heavy on Ashley Madison.
And when the family cupboard is empty, he just goes
he's also
Madison.
On the family.
He's a bad
research,
dude. He's a bad dude.
He absolutely is.
He's
a
on
president.
The Family Research Council or one of those. And it has been disclosed that, again, he molested his sisters. That's not the story, though. The story, as you mentioned, Sam, is that he has now moved to join a lawsuit that his sisters filed against In Touch magazine. The long and short of it is that In Touch was the first to break the story, and they published information that they received under a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act. And they're now suing the magazine, saying that the disclosure has caused us emotional stress, loss of economic gain, which, okay, you could sort of understand their perspective.
Right.
But for him, who's the one who molested them, to say that he also has been hurt.
How does this impact
just
that case? This has got to hurt that case. I mean, everyone agrees that victims should be protected. Why would these lawyers even let him on this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, our friend Jason Whiteside can answer that, because you will find a lawyer to take any case. But, you know, the underlying case actually has no merit, because the sisters, or at least two of them, are the ones who disclose this information on their own to Megyn Kelly on her show. So the underlying case really is going nowhere. But certainly his case, where he is alleging that he was caused emotional distress when he's the one who, you know, abused these women, is just nuts. So hopefully going nowhere.
Get out of my
Maybe
face.
Maybe take the insanity, please.
Yeah, exactly. Is that show still – have anyone ever seen 19?
I didn't even know it was a thing.
No. Kathleen, it's on your regular rotation.
It's my regular
on the DVR.
Schedule. Yeah, I actually watched when the one girl got married. I watched the wedding episode because I'm Irish Catholic. We love a wedding. So any, you know, Kate
sure.
and William,
Kathleen Murphy is Irish?
I know.
No way.
It's tough to decipher, but yeah.
Well, the other – Kate and whoever made Kate eight.
Oh, no, I didn't watch that show.
John and Kate made eight.
I meant Princess
There's also
Kate
issues with that show, right? Wasn't there?
They all have issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, inherently,
the people,
if you're
not
having
the shows.
That many kids, then there's something probably going on. So
the restaurant chain Rosebud. I actually was at Rosebud 2 weeks ago on Taylor Street. It's a restaurant chain, and they are settling a racial discrimination suit. They're going to pay out almost $2 million because of a discrimination suit where they were apparently refusing to hire black applicants at their restaurants.
Yeah, so the EEOC filed a lawsuit in 2013, as you mentioned, accusing 13 of Rosebud's restaurant in engaging in systematic discrimination, specifically by refusing to hire black applicants. They also alleged that the owner of the company and many managers use racial slurs to refer to African Americans. So as part of the consent decree, which is basically a settlement, they have to, as you mentioned, pay $1.9 million, but also agree to new hiring goals where they will ensure that 11% of the future workplace is African American.
Mm-hmm. I think cases like this are where, you know, the market can mete out justice a little faster than the courts, because it mentioned that, you know, several of the restaurants that were included in this have already closed. So if you have people making decisions like that, you're going to have them making a slew of other bad decisions.
Yeah, no question. And you know, to your earlier point, when we asked the Fox News plaintiff's lawyer whether they're trying to change the corporate culture, I mean, you know, it's easy to just say these cases are about money. They are about money, but they're also about, you know, changing the way these companies do business. Mm-hmm. And in this case, part of the settlement, part of the consent decree, is to hire a certain number of applicants who they were not hiring in the past. So that's a good thing.
Illinois offensive lineman Simon Svijanovic. This was a couple of years back. This was when Tim Beckman was the head coach. He had accused Beckman of so many things, all these allegations about making people play through pain and just trying to completely throw everything they do under the bus and name call and spit at them. And and it was really bad. The settlement is pretty groundbreaking, around $250,000. But still, Simon says he's not safe walking on campus. He still feels uncomfortable with the whole thing.
Is he afraid? What is he afraid? Someone's going to tackle him?
He's also about 6'6", 300 pounds.
So you're playing football, right? The other thing is that he wants, like, they want to unionize players to get better medical care. Well, U of I's budget has grown 13 times the rate of student employment. They, you know, they have $600,000 salary for the president. Their budget should allow for proper medical care without players unionizing.
No, you're right.
Very strange.
I just think that, and I knew players that played on that team, down in Champaign. They used to take players that fell out of favor. They would take them and put their equipment and their lockers in the basement with no lights, no running water, and they're mostly black players.
Yeah.
They were all sent down there, and they had to deal with it, and he would call them, you know, pathetic and say that they couldn't cut it, and this is where you belong. I mean, you can't do that either.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's walking that line that we've covered before, that any of us who have played sports, I played football, you know, and hockey my whole life, walk in terms of being treated poorly and being treated, you know, like a football player. Listen, as you mentioned, football is a tough sport, and coaches are not in it to just be nice to you.
Right.
So inherently, whatever sport you play, coaches are going to be tough. And I think some of the best coaches I ever had were the hardest on me. Now, there's a difference between that and abusing, you know, young men and women who are playing for you. There's been lots of cases, and, you know, the Rutgers was a prominent example where lots of people lost their job because of some incredibly poor treatment. You know, would Bobby Knight be employed today? Bobby Knight, you know, was incredibly abusive, including with a Calbert Chaney incident, you know, where he whipped Calbert Chaney, who was an African-American player. I mean, imagine that happening today, where a white coach whips a African-American player. That would never go on.
No.
So there's certainly a line there. I do agree that it's a growing trend. You know, Tim Beckman, I think, paid the price for it with losing his job.
He's also, by the way, Svijanovic is now an artist in Los Angeles. So that football career has been completely derailed. Two more on the grab bag, and then we go. Rich, you remember the boogeyman?
I do,
Derek Bougard, a former NHL player. A federal judge here in Chicago earlier this week dismissed a wrongful death lawsuit against the NHL. Derek Bougard died because of an addiction to painkillers, pretty much.
Yeah, this covers lots of hot-button topics in the world of sports and hockey. Bougard, who was known as the Boogeyman, played several years in the NHL, played 6 years for various teams, first for the Minnesota Wild, eventually for the Rangers. He was like 6'6". He was a tough guy. And his job was to fight, and his job was to enforce, you know, and be the team enforcer.
Skate really fast at somebody and knock them out.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he suffered brain injuries, eventually developed into CTE, according to the lawsuit. And team doctors, again, according to the lawsuit, treated his symptoms with opioid in May of 2011. With opioids in May of 2011, he died. He overdosed on Percocet, and he was 28 years old when he died. So the lawsuit was thrown out this week in Chicago, as you mentioned, by Judge Feinerman. Not on the substance of the lawsuit. It was actually a technicality because of where he brought the suit. They ruled that he should have brought it in Minnesota, and it should have been brought by trustees, so a couple of legal technicalities, but the judge did end his order by saying that he criticized the NHL culture of violence. So there's lots of pending lawsuits like this. One of the questions always that you deal with in this kind of lawsuit, and the reason the NFL case settled, was causation, right? How do you prove, if you're Derek Bougard's family or any of the NFL players, that it was your 6 years in the NHL that caused your CTE versus the, you know, 15 years before that you were playing hockey?
Yeah. What is there anything that can be done about these players' long-term injuries, long-term? Is there anything?
They're trying to institute, I mean, lots of rules. I mean,
fighting.
Lots of rules. I mean, fighting has gone way down.
And now players that have passed, like Steve Monitor played for the Blackhawks and committed suicide.
Yeah.
His brain was donated to science. And it's happening now with football players, too.
Dave Duerson was a famous example.
And even in high school, they've changed a lot of the rules because of the injuries kids were getting. So
The concussion protocols
rules. Mm-hmm. The technology is better than it was.
And, of course, back then, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, nobody wanted to come out of the game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't, you know, they took a finger and checked your eyes, and if they were blinking and moving, you were fine.
Tape it up.
So, It's tough, though. I love the boogeyman. He was a great player. Let's close up the grab bag with another really bad dude. Why not? That's the trend today. War Machine. What a jag this guy is. He's sentenced to life in prison. The former MMA fighter gets life in prison with a chance of parole after 36 years. He was a very vicious assaulter on his ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, I mean, not John Coppenhaver is his real name. He was a UFC fighter, again, went under the name War Machine, and just, you know, a despicable human being. Mm-hmm. He violently beat up his girlfriend, Christy Mack, you know, to the point
and her boyfriend. And then he has a record of assault. I mean, this guy, he sent him to prison. He's going to be running the place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, an incredibly vicious attack over the course of many years on his girlfriend. And, you know, thankfully, the judge gave him a minimum of 36 years. Mm-hmm. But it's very possible that he will serve a life sentence. And, you know, some were critical of that as too harsh. But, man, I mean, there's nothing too harsh for this character.
He fractured her ribs, ruptured her liver, and broke several teeth.
And it's not the first time he's done. I mean, he really is a danger to society. He uses his body as a weapon.
Yeah, and he's now, you know, predictably claimed that he's changed his life.
Oh,
he has found religion.
Of course he found, Jesus.
You know, he said, not a day goes by that I don't seriously regret some of the things I did. I gave my life to God. Now, the good news is about the legal system.
Good.
That
we'll
is
see
not,
in 36 years
yeah,
how that works
exactly.
out.
You don't get to beat up a woman and then the next day claim that you found God and I'm sorry. So, you know, goodbye. There's a special place in hell for these kind of guys. And, yeah, as you mentioned, hopefully maybe he won't make the 36 years. Maybe someone will, you know, do something in prison. But, yeah, not a good way to end our story today.
Kathleen's like, oh, my God, what did I get myself into?
Usually we have a little higher note. But are you an MMA fan at all, Kathleen? Despite War Machine, I think there are some good.
I have seen some matches. It's pretty – it's vicious. It's
what do we think of the Mayweather
McGregor
fight. Is that going to happen, Sam?
I think
what are your
is.
Sources telling you?
My sources tell me that it's going to happen.
What's
now,
the payday? How much are we talking about?
Oh, they'll each get $70 million.
Whoa.
At least.
Really?
The winner will get more.
Holy
the winner
cow.
Always gets more. The
will
person.
Mayweather finally have to get in and, like, you
Here's
know, get,
the issue.
Duke it out and
Here's
trade punches for once?
If Mayweather loses, that is a huge black eye on boxing.
Boxing gets
trumped.
Yeah, but don't you think they asterisk that by saying, well, you know, it was sort of an exhibition. It was one sport against another. And
no, he's the best boxer.
Then they just do a rematch
he's
for another.
He's the best boxer of the last 30 years. And if he loses to an MMA guy, right?
You know what it reminds me of, right? It reminds me of the best scene in all the Rocky movies when Hulk Hogan fought Rocky.
Oh,
they're
going to say him training in a shack
no.
in
well, that,
snowy
that,
mountain.
That's good, too. But Thunderlips against Rocky. They did an exhibition match in the beginning of Rocky III. Remember where Hulk Hogan was a wrestler and Rocky Balboa was a fighter and they fought? And Rocky thought it was just going to be a fun match and Hulk Hogan, Thunderlips, took it seriously. Mm-hmm. And then Rocky takes off his gloves and starts a you know street fight and everyone's happy afterwards. But
and then Rocky IV ended the Cold War.
Are they playing
If he dies,
MMA
he dies.
I don't actually
MMA
know the
rules.
I don't know the rules yet.
Yeah,
I don't
that's
think
a good
it's been determined. It's all speculative.
I don't
right
think
now.
It could be MMA rules because I can't imagine Mayweather like using his feet.
I can't. Yeah.
It's no, got
to
be.
It needs to be what Floyd wants.
Yeah, exactly. So he's the draw. But yeah, that'll be great. I mean, I can't imagine what the ringside seats are going to go for. That's Kathleen Murphy territory, not you know, legal face-off
right.
money.
For Kathleen.
I like to get the blood on me.
Exactly.
For Rich, yeah. I'm Sam. Thanks to Nikki for filling in today. Thanks to Craig Collins. Legal Face-Off on WGN. If you missed anything, go to WGNRadio.com. Type in Legal Face-Off. All the shows are there, and we'll talk to you next time.